Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. Just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ideas in writing.
Hello, I'm Philip Holden, and this is episode 6. I'm definitely going with that numbering from now on, of Ideas in Writing. It's a podcast about words that are spoken, performed, published, and sometimes sung, and in this case, painstakingly hand-drawn. Because this time it's with very lovely and talented Rickard sisters, creators of what I think is one of the books of the year. It's a graphic novel version of The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists. It's a long, sometimes difficult read, but in this version, it gives new life to this hugely influential book by Robert Tressel. Sophie and Scarlett are from Lancashire originally, but now live in Cheshire and in Kent. So we talk about how they started writing and drawing and the difficulties of adapting such a huge and important book and their admiration for TV and film adaptations. And we talk about social justice. The word Sophie and Scarlett brought with them was perhaps naturally philanthropist, but for reasons that you might not have thought about. And I suggested the word sketch. So here's my chat with Sophie and Scarlett Rickard, philanthropist, sketch. So, hello, Sophie, and hello, Scarlett.
Hello, Philip.
It's nice to meet you online, as it were, in these strange times. How are you doing?
Pretty well. I think these strange times kind of suit us quite well in a funny kind of way, because we both quite like being at home.
Oh, yeah. No, I must admit, I appreciate that. It's nice not getting on a train or having to get in the car all the time.
I think we also invented remote working because we work together very closely from 200 miles away and have done for years. So that hasn't been too stressful for us.
No, we're quite used to this kind of thing.
Yeah, that's I think one of the intriguing things about the way you work, because you've obviously, for people who don't know, you've produced two books together, Man's Best Friend, which I just read 2 days ago. And we'll come on to talk about The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists, which is an amazing book. I think it's beautiful to look at, and it just works so well. But we'll come on to talk about that in a minute, because that's how I came across you two. But you work together remotely, and you kind of carve up the writing of the book absolutely down the middle, don't you? It's words and pictures.
Yeah, we have a very sort of clear idea of whose job's what, but that's not to say that we don't stick our nose in each other's business as well.
It's not as cut and dried as straight down the middle, is it, really? I mean, it nearly is.
So it's to make the story in words, and it's Scarlett's job to make the story in pictures, which is a good thing because I'm not as good at drawing. And so... although we start off like that, we then work together in the sense that we'll have a, say, a FaceTime conversation and be able to see what each other are doing, and we'll come up with a storyboard. So those things like what happens in what order starts off being my job, but then ends up being more of a collaboration. And then as Scarlett draws, she shows me what she's doing as she goes along, and sometimes I pick holes in it, and sometimes I just think, oh, that's brilliant.
Come on, Scarlett.
No, I was just going to say, I really like drawing stuff that Sophie might not expect.
Okay. What kind of things?
You can tell from the books that where, like, there are details that no one would have put in the script. Like, there's no way that I would have asked her to draw a horse doing a poo in The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist, but she still did it. And it's things like that that you can tell that we're going out of our way to make each other laugh.
Yeah. I have to say, one of the things that I noticed about The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist, I'm a great fan of Janet Olberg's illustrations for the Olberg's books, Alan and Janet Olberg. I don't know whether you know those, but
yeah, very much.
And I just thought there were real echoes of that, the sort of detail in that, and some of those sign writing and the shop fronts and the lighting in the street is so evocative. I really enjoyed that.
Oh, that's great. Oh, what an accolade to be compared to the Olbergs.
One of the things they did so brilliantly was that although they're making children's books, there are loads of grown-up jokes in there, and this is years before Pixar started doing that with film. You know?
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
And, you know, when you read Burglar Bill, there's a lot there for the parent to read as well.
Yeah, actually my favourite book.
Yeah, the best.
I mean, of all books. I don't just mean children's books. I mean, it's just perfect.
Yeah. I think The Jolly Postman is my favourite book as the artist of the gang.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's very much a kind of event, isn't it? I mean, it's not even just a book. It's
brilliant. It's so immersive. And I love the idea. I mean, as a child, I loved the idea of making fake real things. There's just something so fantastic about opening all the letters and having sort of what's it called, you know, junk mail but drawn.
Yes,
I loved that. I just absolutely loved it.
I think
yes, the witch's catalogue, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
Scarlett loves an artifact, and she loves all of that social history, which you can see from the book. That she really notices those kind of details. And I think that's part of the aspect of The Jolly Postman that you like, because you're opening up and discovering things.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
So where did this all start? Obviously, your sisters, I don't know whether I say that obviously, but people might not have realised that.
Occasionally, whether we're actual sisters or, like, you know, sisters, as in the sisterhood, but we are.
Oh, okay.
We have the same parents.
Right. <Yeah. laughs> And you're born in Lancashire. So whereabouts in Lancashire? I'm from Lancashire as well, I should say.
Oh, all the best people are from Lancashire, obviously.
Absolutely.
We were born and brought up in Worley, which is near Clitheroe.
I know exactly where Worley is. My best friend used to live on Worley Road.
Oh, wow.
Accrington, yeah.
Oh, I went to college in Accrington.
What? To, what's it called?
Lottendale.
Yeah, so did I. Went for sixth form, yeah, yeah.
Well, I find out you're in the same class now.
No, no, I'm far too old for that.
I don't know. You can never tell with these things.
How old you think we are?
I think you're probably in your late 20s. I was saying to Scarlett that Scarlett. See, I'm already mixing it up already. That before I started, that I had this picture of you as kind of hippies living in a teepee or a yurt or something, and I don't know how accurate that is, but I definitely have you pictured as much younger than me. But no, so you started off in Worley,
yeah. Which calls itself a village, but really, I mean, it's a bit big to get away with that now, especially recently. I think they've built a lot more houses in that area now.
But it's a lovely area.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yeah, and I live down in Kent now, and I do really miss, you know, the Pennines and the just being in the hills and the lack of people.
People in Kent don't really know what a hill is, do they?
No, there's hills around Folkestone that they call hills. They're not hills, they're pimples.
Around your way, don't you get big white pictures on your hills? That's quite exciting.
Yeah, we do. We've got a big white horse on one of our little tiny pimples. Yeah, they're making the most of them.
There's no big white horses on Worley Nab.
No, but no. Worley Nab was my favourite place. I used to love going up there.
Yeah.
Going up this little hill and you sit on top and you could see all down the valley and it was just great. Yeah, miss that.
There's a lot of that in Man's Best Friend. You'll have found the landscape familiar, Philip.
Yes, of course. Yeah, yeah. That's another thing that endeared it to me. Yeah. Yeah, so I know it's a sort of truism to say, but it has a real sense of place. It's kind of located in a particular place rather than somewhere generic. So so growing up in Worley, did your kind of education so on take you in different directions now that one of you is writing and one of you is drawing?
It's kind of always been that way. So Scarlett has always drawn, always, and she used to say, even like probably before I could write, tell me what to draw, tell me what to draw. So making stuff up is kind of what I do. And she makes it real. So, but we haven't worked really closely our whole lives. There was a big, big chunk in our 20s where we hardly were in touch with each other. We used to catch up on news through our parents. I lived abroad and I've had two children and gone off and done different things, and Scarlett was playing in a band, and you know, we went in different directions, but then in our 30s we ended up on the same metaphorical sofa because we both have a what we now know is a genetic heritable condition that made us both quite poorly, and it took a while to work out what was going on, and now we know what it is, we're better at managing it and being able to work together and understand each other, and being able to work lying down on our own respective sofas has made all the difference.
So that was the kind of real moment of change, was it?
It was, really, because I sort of got ill first with it. I'm a little bit older than Sophie, and I was working very hard. I was working for an arts company, doing quite long hours, and I just got more and more and more exhausted until I ended up in hospital. And when I came out of hospital, I couldn't work, and I was signed off sick for 6 months. And I remember going up to stay with our mum, and she took me over to a pub that Sophie and her husband were running at the time. And it's the first time I'd really seen much of Sophie for a long time. And I remember saying, I really want to draw something. I sort of need to draw something. Tell me what to draw. And Sophie was tidying up, like, you know, the empties at the end of the night. And she just said, she just started telling me this story. And it was Man's Best Friend.
Oh, wow.
And that's how we started, really. So in a way, it was kind of occupational therapy for me at the beginning, and then it became occupational therapy for Sophie a bit later on.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So you described the process of writing Man's Best Friend as a bit more chaotic.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, we really didn't know what we were doing. And I'm not completely sure we do now, but we've got more experience.
Yeah.
We don't have a background in comics like a lot of people who work in this industry do. We're far more, you know, Alberg in our approach, really. And we kind of just enjoy the fun of making up stories, you know. And so when we were doing Man's Best Friend, although we knew at the end of it there would be a book, it wasn't really the goal. In fact, I don't remember while I was drawing it thinking, what, you know, I don't remember knowing what we were going to do with it at the end.
Oh, really?
It was kind of the process of making it was the fun bit. Yeah, I don't remember thinking, oh, yeah, we're going to have a book.
Exactly. Well, it was very exciting when we did.
Oh, it was really exciting.
I think I would really count it as one of the best days of my life, the day that the proof copy of Man's Best Friend turned up. And I sat next to my husband in bed while he read it, and him laughing out loud at all the funny bits. Just, oh, it was...
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah.
When my children were born, for sure.
Yeah, there is something about seeing it made real. And also, I think seeing more than one copy of it.
Yeah, having some on a shelf is something I will never get over, I don't think.
One of the things that I really love is hearing other people talk about characters I've made up. So I spend a lot of time in a fictional universe in my head, and it's always been quite a private situation that nobody else engages in. But with my best friend, and you have, I mean, I don't know about you, but people tend to have quite visceral feelings about some of the characters. And it took us aback a bit, didn't it, Scarlett, how much people really hated Terry's sister.
Yes, because it's sort of unfiltered, isn't it? I mean, you live with these characters, but they just have, as you say, that sort of visceral reaction as if they're real.
Yeah, I mean, funnily enough, with Man's Best Friend, because it's not a massively long book, it's 148 pages, I think. Although Sophie and I know all the sort of background of the characters, and you know, we've had such a laugh about people who just happen to be walking past in the street and stuff, because we invented this town, Oldroyd, which is it's Lancashire, but I'm basically reclaiming Todmorden for Lancashire.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, that's right and proper.
That's quite
cool. Yeah, it's only right. So it's kind of Calderdale, but it's Lancashire. We'd made up all these backstories and stuff for the characters, and so for us it's a whole world. It was quite fun sort of watching people reacting to it. But with The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist, I actually felt the same as people do when they're reading books. I like the characters for The Ragged Child Philanthropist started off just as drawings, and as I was drawing them, they became real people to me as well. They brought on their own kind of their own thoughts and feelings and personality, and I was just sort of a conduit. It was very odd. I think because it was a long book, I spent a lot of time with them.
It was true for me as well, even to the point that I handed over a script that's sort of like a screenplay to Scarlett for the drawing to begin. And by that stage, we'd cut it down from 255,000 words to about, was it 35, Scarlett?
About 30,000.
Including like stage directions and stuff. So you can imagine, I'd spent a lot of time in that world with those people and really trying really carefully to make it shorter without losing anything, which is hard. And then Scarlett started drawing these people, and there were characters that I didn't particularly like in the original, and even in my adaptation, that I thought they were unpleasant. And once Scarlett started drawing them, and our process is that she'll send me a page as she goes, so it's almost like getting a subscription. I love it. But these people grew on me, and I started to feel much warmer towards some of them and to see a different side of them, which is really extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, it is like it takes on a life of its own.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, Sophie, then, how did you get to the point where you had the confidence to tackle this huge book and to think you could edit it down?
I don't know how to answer that question. It was foolishness. It was Scarlett's idea. I'll blame her. Scarlett knew that the book was so well loved and so difficult to get on with, and was very aware that all of that detail that's in there is very visual, like a lot of stuff about the actual work that the men do and the decorating and those kind of things, you know, it is really expressive and wordy and could be shown well in pictures. So she persuaded me.
Okay, so Scarlett, you came across the book, or you were kind of engaged with the book before?
I wouldn't say engaged in a traditional manner. I was given the book by my
godfather. Sophie's laughing at that for some reason.
I was given the book by my godfather, and when I was about 12 or 13, I think, and it was a hardback. Yeah, too young. It was a hardback, and it was massive. And so really, for most of our childhoods and adolescence, we used it to weigh down tents when we were building dens with old dust sheets and things.
Fair enough.
It was a heavy weight. It was a useful heavy weight. And it was only much later in life, in fact, probably only 10, 15 years ago, that I found, I don't know what happened to the original copy, but I found another copy of it, and I thought, I should probably read this, really, because my godfather intended me to do that. And so I started reading it and was really struck by how visual it was. And yeah. Then because at that point we weren't making books and I wasn't in touch with Sophie particularly, I just kind of put it on the shelf in my mind and forgot about it. And then when the real sort of surge of socialism and the Labour Party happened, it and we'd done Man's Best Friend, I just thought, this is the book we should be doing.
Yeah.
It came back to me.
So how did you persuade Sophie that she could edit it from 250,000 words?
With the use of an audiobook.
I love audiobooks. But to be fair, I also really love very long, depressing books. They're my favourite kind.
Go on, name another one that you really love, just so we've got a recommendation.
Oh, Les Miserables.
Oh, okay.
Hard Times.
Yeah.
Wuthering Heights.
Yeah, those all work, yeah.
Long, miserable books. My children once went into a bookshop looking for a birthday present for me. My husband reported this, and the nice bookseller leant down to Max, who must have been 6 or 7 or something at the time, and said, "What kind of books does Mummy like?" And apparently Max said, "She likes ones where everyone dies at the end." So yeah. I do have form.
Yeah. So you, were you keen to take it on then? I mean, it just seems such a daunting task.
To be honest, if I had truly appreciated how daunting it was when I started, I might have had more qualms, but I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah.
I think it's a good thing to bite off more than you can chew sometimes and just take your time and keep going.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So, I was just going to say that. Sorry, that was the audio book that kind of made it accessible to you.
I like audio books anyway, and I tend to listen to speech radio almost all the time. Mm. So it's a format I'm very comfortable with, and I listen again to some of those ones that I just reeled off that I love.
Yeah,
having the audio books of Dickens is one of my pain relief strategies because I find it really relaxing. So being able to have the audiobook as well as the textbook really helps you feel like you're in it and, you know, get to know it. To start chopping a book up, you've got to really know it inside out.
Yeah, that's what I thought, yeah.
So clever how she did it. I mean, sort of cutting it all up. I mean, she had a piece of lining paper, you know, really long piece of lining paper divided up into the months of the years that the book covers. And she had post-it notes stuck all over it for all the different scenes and what's going on. You know, so she made it a kind of visual thing. I was just really in awe of the whole process. It was amazing.
Then I really upset Scarlett by starting at the beginning and the end and working my way to the middle.
That does sound crazy.
Well, it does, but the middle of the original novel is a kind of misery swamp that's quite hard to get through, I think, as a reader, or I felt anyway. And I wanted to... The start has the setup and the end has all the action, and so I wanted to meet in the middle to make the swamp hold all of that up instead of drag it down.
Yeah, I see what you mean. But what you came up with, and I know you had your big folder of the pages and the story. What you came up with, as you say, was a screenplay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, because it's like writing for telly, and Scarlett gets to choose the locations, the costume, the actors, all of the props, and the weather.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about the weather. Yeah, I am. Yeah. The god of Mugsborough.
But we've discovered since then that real comic art teams, they have a writer, an artist, a colourist and a letterer.
Yeah.
And an inker sometimes. One person does the pencils and another person inks it.
But what I couldn't believe is that the writer tells, when I'd say I tell Scarlett what to draw, I don't tell her what to put in each panel. Like, that's...
No.
That's her job.
But some of your descriptions do open a scene, don't they? They say it's an interior, it's nighttime, and so on.
And
so that's exactly.
Know each other so well, I can write something like, for instance, when we were doing Man's Best Friend, I could write something like Terry is appalled, and just leave it to Scarlett to show that.
In fact, I remember in Man's Best Friend, I think there was a couple of places that said Terry's face.
Yeah, Terry's face.
When we were kids, our parents had a friend who was an actress on Coronation Street. And,
all right.
She played Renee Roberts. Renee Roberts, Alf Roberts' wife.
Fair.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember Mum saying that she'd gone to the set of Coronation Street and Madge had shown her the script. And at the end of Coronation Street, just before the theme tune, there's always somebody's reaction. And on the script, it just says, Alf's face.
Oh, really?
And because it focuses in on Alf's reaction, and then it's the end of the programme. And so we've kept that in.
That's very cool. That's really good. So has it occurred to you that somebody could pick up the Ragged Trouser Philanthropist as it is and shoot it as a film?
Yeah, I think it's really common for people to make films from graphic novels because we've basically done all the work in a sense. I mean, not to take away from the huge amount of effort and talent that goes into making a film. But I mean, a lot of making a graphic novel is to do with pacing and camera angles and, you know, all of that stuff.
What I'd really like for this one is for somebody to turn it into an animated film like Ethel and Ernest.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Yeah. In fact, while I was drawing it, I like what I was saying about them sort of taking on a character of their own. I remember actually sort of half imagining these people moving as I was drawing them towards the end.
Yeah,
it would be great to do an animated film. Yeah,
that would take a long time.
And having done a little bit of animation myself, I don't think I want to do it by myself.
It is COVID secure though, animating.
Sorry,
COVID secure, isn't it?
I suppose so. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, yeah. And I was just looking at the looking at the picture of the one of the characters walking past the confectioner's shop on the corner, and it's called Ormish's, which was my auntie's married name.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good coincidence.
Yeah. But you're right. I mean, as you say, the sort of picture paints a thousand words. I mean, I don't think your pictures need to do 1,000 words, actually, thinking how many pictures there are in the book. But you've got, you must have, in a way, more kind of vivid detail in your version of the book than there was in the original. Because it's known as being, I suppose, quite preachy in its original approach.
Yeah, I think the original is, and in a way it is, but it also is, I think that there was some things that Tressel did which are very clever as storytelling devices. Like he repeats himself a lot. And what Sophie did was kind of keep that in a sense, but reduce the number of repeats down. because what he does is he explains, you know, where the workmen are all sitting together and Owen's rattling on about politics again, he explains an economic situation in words, and then it happens to the characters in action straight afterwards.
Yeah.
So that you can see it actually happening and you're referring back to what you've just learned about, you know. So, and it's a very clever way of getting ideas across. And of course, that works much better in a graphic novel, in a sense, because, you know, you can see it all happening. It's unfolding visually. But I think the original, I mean, it had a lot of descriptive stuff in it, but it was quite sort of, I don't want to say nitpicky, but it's kind of like describing the work of the painters and decorators to the, you know, the grit of the sandpaper. You know, I mean, it was very macro, sort of description. Yeah. So in a way, I actually jettisoned some of that description, in order to be able to draw the book in a sensible number of pages.
Yeah, but I suppose, it shows that there's kind of a really successful filtering process gone on there, because, you know, ultimately some of that detail is unnecessary, but the detail that's now in there, as I say, again, a real sense of place and time, and a, you know, a really good movie, you know, a kind of a very strict palette, so it's consistent, and those are things that you wouldn't necessarily get from the original book, which was, I know, Sophie, you said something about ending up not really liking Robert Tressel.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit cheeky of me, really, since we're very much eating from his table, but I spent a lot of time locked in a room with him, in a sense, and I'm not convinced that when he was writing the original he had his reader in mind at all.
Right.
He was brilliant and he had a lot to say and was extremely frustrated that people weren't listening to him, and it kind of shows.
Right.
So, but the longer I spent with him, the more I came to admire the way he went about things. Like Scarlett says, the device of showing these economic theories simply explained and challenged with all of the things that we all hear in the pub all the time, like it's not for the likes of us and all of that. I mean, it's impossible to read either his version or our version without thinking of like modern equivalence that's happening around us right now.
Yeah.
But then to show it using a bunch of people you've come to love is like a soap opera. So I think that the book is famous about, like you say, it's known for being preachy, and I think that Robert Tressel's communication style was on the preachy side, I very much agree. Yeah. But what people remember about it is these politics lessons and these conversations of it, that people will say it's about, this book is about a load of workmen who work together, but it's actually about the whole community. It's about those men's whole lives, their whole domestic situations. It's got their wives and their parents and their children, because one of the things that it does is shows how poverty affects every aspect of a person's life. So not that much of it is about work, really.
No.
But that's how the men know each other.
Yeah. I must admit, when I did read it, the original, which I read as a, I think I read it as a Kindle book because it's free, as you said. I think it's the original is free.
Not as heavy.
Sorry?
Not as heavy to carry around.
No, I have to say I don't have a Kindle anymore because it broke and I didn't want to replace it, so. I don't like it.
Anyway, the tents down.
No, exactly. But when I read it, I mean, I think the two things that really struck me about it, one is, as you say, it's sort of the applicability to modern times, and the sort of persistence of poverty and the way it's kind of structurally embedded in society. And kind of reinforced, and of course the money trick, that sort of demonstration of kind of how it works. But also I think I thought at the time that the device of them all working on this big house was sort of obviously a device, if you see what I mean.
Very much so. I mean, the house is called the Cave, which I took to mean Plato's Cave.
Oh, yeah, never occurred to me, yes.
He's in Plato's cave is all about how the people are sitting and they're seeing these shapes on the wall, which they think is their whole life because that's all they can see. But actually, yeah, the shapes on the wall are the shadows cast from puppets held up against a fire. And mm-hmm. that's exactly what he's saying. The working people are seeing this and thinking it's all there is, but that's because it's the only thing that capitalism is letting them understand.
So it absolutely speaks to nowadays, doesn't it, with the idea of power controlling the narrative or controlling culture. And my favourite French social theorist, Pierre Bourdieu, says we're all fish in water. We don't notice the water.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I'm just reading at the moment Fully Automated Luxury Communism by Aaron Bastani. And he's teaching me all about capitalist realism, which is what all of us at our age have very much grown up with, understanding that it's the only viable way to organize society, that anything like that. And you can see it in the regatas of philanthropists. They say there'll always be rich and poor in the world. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. Human nature is human nature as well, is something that keeps coming up.
Yeah. And it comes up, I mean, it's particularly apposite at the moment in a sort of non-economic sphere, isn't it? And this constant debate about how much we can control people during the pandemic. And, you know, the argument, you can't put controls on people over Christmas because they won't respect them anyway. And it's, as you say, Scarlett, it's human nature, isn't it?
Yeah, it'll be what, you know, it is the whole sort of...
But look at the way they've handled it in the East. Mm. Not human nature, it's an individualistic community and society, a way of understanding things. If we had a more communal understanding, then people wouldn't want to be mixing at Christmas.
But I guess what that sort of control, particularly kind of through, I suppose, mass media does, is it gives people the tools to think about how much they're empowered to do something about a situation like this. So even if you are in a community like Aldroyd, that is, it is a community, the way you think about it is so shaped by the media you consume and absolutely the stories you're told about it.
And it's interesting that the way, I mean, obviously I blame Thatcher for a lot of things, but the way that society in Britain now is very much kind of, it's kind of being set up to be individualistic, even if people on the ground are actively more community minded, or some of them are, the way the sort of the narrative is we should all be fighting individually against lockdown or against, it's this kind of weird freedom thing where freedom is individuals shouting into the void instead of actively coming together and realizing there's actually different ways of doing things that might be better for everybody. It's almost like a divide and rule situation that's gone down to the very tiny increments of individual people in the country dividing from everybody else. It's a very strange time.
It is, and it is. You do kind of feel it's echoed or amplified by social media, which is appears to be social, but is actually individualistic.
Like antisocial in a lot of ways.
But it can be a brilliant way of getting together with people that you want to make connections with as well.
So it can be, I think,
positive sides for people's mental health as well as the negatives.
I suppose that, there's a question about how you navigate between those two. And I don't know the answer to that. I'm always being told off for using Twitter.
This conversation is reminding me to tell you about the word that we wanted to bring.
Oh, Goodness me, yes. Thank you, Sophie. That. Yes, I did. And I had a note in front of me to say words. So, yes, go on. And what was your word?
We've decided to bring one word between us.
Good idea.
And we decided to bring a word that's very long and hard to pronounce and really annoying to fit on the cover, which is philanthropist.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So Robert Tressel has gifted us with a wonderful story and an absolutely impossible title.
Yeah.
It doesn't fit anywhere and people can't say it. So the word philanthropist, I mean, it's the opposite of a misanthropist. So
yeah,
it, coming from Greek, it means man love, but not in the fun way.
Yeah.
So it's somebody who's feeling altruistic towards humankind and putting their money where their mouth is.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of, I mean, the ragged trousered philanthropists is a very sarcastic title, because what Tressel is saying is that these are the poor people who are, by means of charity, keeping the rich afloat.
Yeah.
And that's the message of the book. And that hasn't changed much.
No.
The comedian Hennig Venn says, in Germany, we don't do charity, we just pay our taxes.
Yeah.
And it's a good point. I mean, I think the things that, for example, Marcus Rashford has been doing in the last few months are absolutely incredible for raising awareness and the profile of what it's like to grow up in modern Britain with not enough to live on, even though your parents are working as hard as they can.
Yeah.
But still people are not saying why.
Yeah.
And there's some people that are digging their hands in their pockets and giving money for things like Marcus Rashford's appeal.
Well, that whole Captain Tom thing, raising money for the NHS. Why isn't anybody appalled that the NHS isn't getting enough money from our taxes in the first place? It shouldn't be.
Yeah, it's shocking, isn't it?
And when you look at by proportion of your income, poor people give far, far, far more to charity than rich people.
Yeah, and indeed still pay more tax.
Yes, pay more tax, absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
No, I was utterly amazed where, you know, the UN rapporteur, that's the word, thank you. Yes, thank you. On poverty, the report a year or so ago on the growth of childhood poverty in the UK. And I was just amazed that got so little attention.
Mm. Food banks is another one, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's become completely normal and a nice middle-class thing to do to pop a couple of tins in the food bank basket in the supermarket while you're there.
Mm. Yeah. Oh,
sorry.
Hello.
That is our mother, right on cue. She always does this.
Does she want to join in?
Probably. She would
love it.
She'll be really social next.
I put myself on Do Not Disturb.
Oh, I wish.
No, I like the choice of word anyway. I mean, it's absolutely opposite. I'm just reminded that connecting it up with social media, I used to, because I did a degree in anthropology, I used to choose as my username philanthropologist.
Oh, that's a good one.
That's a good one.
It's been used a lot though, I think. So it's not always available.
Yeah, but
my word.
Because
I'm called Phil. Yes.
Yeah. No. I was saying, are they all called Phil? All the other people who've used it?
I don't know. That's a good point. My word, for what it's worth, was going to be sketch.
Mm.
Only because it seemed to unite the sort of process of sketching out the story, drawing the pictures, and also this idea which fascinated me of writing this as a screenplay, there's a sort of theatricality about it, and an economy of line and words that I think
it has. Doing the Ragged Trousers of Philanthropist particularly has made me really appreciate partly really appreciate adaptations on television, yeah. but generally just really appreciate television drama. You know, it's made me really appreciate, you know, the kind of camera angles and the, you know, the tension and stuff, and yeah. how people get feelings across. I feel quite like it. You know, it is a similar sort of approach, really.
Yeah,
it's a bit nerdy, but one of the things my son and I have to do is to watch three or four different adaptations of the same story one after the other, and then talk about the choices that they made. That, you know, it's a real art form, and doing this made me appreciate that. All the time I was doing it, I was had the sort of this voice on my shoulder that there are people that absolutely love this book and love it, and it's their actual Bible. And
yeah,
I kind of kept saying to myself, whatever I do, it's going to be wrong for someone. But if I do my best, then I can just say, if you don't like it, what would you have done? Off you go. You have a go, you know. And it made me realize that, you know, like there's an adaptation of one of the Austens that drives me absolutely mad because they miss out what I think is the most important scene in the book. But I feel a lot more generous towards that person than I used to.
Yeah, because one thing that you don't take into account is the restriction that they might be under of time, for example. They can only, like, our book had to be this length. We couldn't make it any longer because it was going to start getting unviable.
Right.
And so you've got to make decisions based on brevity as well as artistically. You know, there's all kinds of stuff where you have to make a decision of how to show something in the shortest possible way.
Yeah, I mean, it is all about making those decisions, isn't it? And I guess some of those make themselves, do they? I mean, in the sense that, you know, you miss out something or you avoid doing something that's difficult.
Some of them are easier than others. So,
yeah.
Like, there were things that got in it that were still in it far enough for Scarlett to have drawn them, and then they got cut.
Yeah. We have deleted scenes.
Yeah. Oh, right. So there's DVD extras.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because...
I was just going to say, how does that happen, Scarlett? How does that work? But does that mean you have to redraw? Were you drawing frames or were you drawing whole pages?
No, I draw whole pages. So
did you have to redraw?
Yeah, or just cut them out altogether in some cases, just remove them because we had to shorten the book. Our publisher, Self Made Hero, have been brilliant. And one of the things that they did early on was to put us together with an editor who isn't actually an editor. He's a comic artist and writer himself, David Hine. And he doesn't really like being classed as an editor because he thinks editors are annoying. But he was really brilliant because he had a lot of experience with working in comics, which we hadn't. And so he was more like a mentor, really, as we went through the process. I've said before, I really feel like doing the Ragged Trousers with Philanthropists was our kind of Beatles in Hamburg moment. It whipped us into shape.
We managed to get so far with a script that was too long that we ended up throwing a chapter of art away.
Yeah.
Right.
Which we wouldn't do now. But sometimes you have to learn the hard way in Hamburg.
Yeah. Because I can't remember how far into the book we got before Dave came on board. I think, but we'd drawn quite a lot of it. There was halfway through, there was a moment where the publisher said there were too many words on the page. You know, we have to cut it down. And so Sophie and I, using the miracle of remote working, had a shared document of the script, and we went through it from beginning to end, cutting it down together, which was a really good process, actually. It was really interesting because one of the things is that we decided at the beginning, we tried to keep the language as original as we could to Trestles, but it became quite clear that if you're going to sell this to a modern audience as a graphic novel, it would be better not to have really archaic Edwardian language with sentences that go on for...
Yes.
It would be better to make it more accessible. And so at that point, we modernised it.
Okay. So that was relatively late in the process.
Yeah. Too late, really. Yeah. And then we went back and redid all the lettering. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Because the other thing that people don't necessarily appreciate is that every word is written by Scarlett by hand.
Yeah, a lot of people make fonts these days to like their handwriting.
Yes.
But there's something about actively writing it that makes me feel more connected to the reader somehow. It's like I've personally looked over every single detail on this
page
somehow. You know, it's like it's more of a connection.
And I think it feels different anyway. I mean, I don't think any of those kind of handwriting fonts, however much they vary, kind of feel quite right.
I think there's something about it, the emotion when you're writing something and it's an emotional thing, it somehow comes across, and I don't know how, but I think that when you're doing it by hand, it you're in the moment as well as the person who's reading it is.
I think that's right, and I think it does come across. I mean, it just fits together so well in that as I say, when you read it, it's kind of it's so well put together, and as I say, I love the sign writing and the and those aspects, which must have taken you forever.
Unbelievably quick. That's one of the things that made this slightly less of a ridiculous idea than it might have been, is that Scarlett really does tear through the work. She wouldn't be popular on a building site.
No. Sorry, I'm being distracted because the bin men are here, but it's Wednesday and that's not what's supposed to happen.
What is the world coming
does
to?
Does this mean that your bin's not going to get collected?
I'm wondering that. Yeah. I don't know. It's all very mysterious. Sorry, it was very distracting. Right.
No, it's all right.
The world's gone mad.
I do work quite quickly, but while I was doing it, of course, I was working on work as well, and so I was doing ridiculous hours. Towards the end, I was averaging about a page of art a day.
For months.
I mean, it was 18 months of drawing, pretty much.
Yeah.
And I was doing, you know, like 6 hours of paid work and then 8 hours of Ragged Trouser straight after it. So I was sort of starting work like 7 every morning and finishing at 10 for months. And when it all finished, it was that weird kind of, what do I do with all this time?
Yeah. I mean, both of you do other jobs as well.
Yeah.
So it's not... Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, although mine is almost the same because I draw, so I'm a graphic artist, so I do poster design and illustration, so it's not that different really to
well, I'm gonna have to commission you then to do some illustration, I think.
Oh, I'm up for that.
I think about that. Yeah.
Especially now that all my clients are dropping off the face of the earth, because a lot of my clients are events and musicians. And of course, none of those people can do anything now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Meanwhile, my alter ego has just been getting busier and busier because, I mean, although I do write stuff, I got a rejection for a radio play this morning, so that's nice.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. I work for NSPCC Childline. And so, as you can imagine, over the course of the pandemic, that's all got quite busy and heavy. So I feel like it does feed into my writing life, because every story under the sun exists out there and you really do get windows into lives that you wouldn't otherwise come across. But I It would be unprofessional for me to be harvesting them for fiction, so I don't tend to do that.
No.
Counselling and fiction are far more related than I think people might think.
I can understand that, yeah. A lot of the sort of damage that we sustain is about the stories we tell ourselves and the stories other people tell us about us.
Yeah, very much.
But also I think there's a lot to be said for representation, isn't there, as well? You know, fiction can really play a part in helping people with mental health and stuff. And also, I mean, it was something when we were working on Ragged Trousers Philanthropists during the sort of busy period in the Labour Party when there was a lot of activism, and I mean, round here particularly, you know, there was a really active Labour group, it still is, but it's a very active Labour group of activists all going out doing things. And I was sort of feeling guilty that physically I wasn't able to do that stuff, but also I couldn't just because I was drawing a book. And Sophie said that Marx, there was this quote from Marx about how people like Dickens have done far more for for social progress than politicians have, because when you read a book that's about somebody else's situation that you wouldn't have otherwise ever come across or ever understood, it goes in, doesn't it? It affects people in a different way. So people recognise Oliver Twist's awful situation. And they might be more inclined to notice what's making that happen.
Yeah, I mean, that is the power of books and theatre and film, isn't it? As you say, representation. So to pick up on that, your Ragged Education idea, project.
Yeah.
So hashtag ragged education. That's difficult to say that. You're asking people to donate a copy or request a copy?
Yeah, so there's a page on our website, which is rickardsisters.com, where you can click a button to donate the cover price of a copy of the Ragged Trousered Philanthropist graphic novel, and we will send it to a sixth form college or a prison library that requests it. And there's a equally appealing button there on the website for you if you work with young people aged sort of 16 to 18 or in a prison or in a place where you think that there ought to be a copy of the book in the library, and we'll send you one. And at the moment we actually have more donations than requests. So,
oh really?
I don't think that's true. Right, as of this morning.
Oh really? Oh, I'm behind.
I think we're equal.
We're running equal. Okay, Scarlett's better at keeping up to date with these things than I do all the parcels.
Oh, that's great. No, I mean, and I'm sure you know, Mr. Books will do what they can to support that as well. We did tweet about the book, and we got a parent of a child in Spain requesting a copy of the book.
Amazing.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah. So hopefully we'll get more of that, because it is such a, I know I've sung its praises already, but it's such a great accessible version of a really important book.
And I think earlier before we started, I was making a joke about your son's generation being so clean living and mechanical.
Not liking the theme tune.
But I think that the current generation of teenagers, maybe up to age sort of 23, are so politically engaged. They've been through so much. They've been noticing everything's been on fire, and they've also been brought up to expect to be able to do something about it. And so I think it's really important to help them to get the language and the confidence to keep going
and to
do something about it, because I think they might be our only hope.
Yeah.
Especially I think by definition they are.
Yeah. But yes, of course. Yeah. But with the environmentally as well, they're very, very much more proactive about, you know, the sort of environmental crisis.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the older generation who are running everything just aren't taking it seriously at all. Just it kind of, well, all the time you can make money off it, they'll be making money rather than rescuing things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So which brings me to two other questions. I know we're kind of up against an hour, and I don't want to take up all your morning.
Oh, no, we're quite happy to matter. It's good fun.
Yeah, it is good. One was that commission, Scarlett, I'm talking about. Did I send you a copy of my book? It's got a short story in called The Girl Who Bought the Moon.
Oh, no, I don't think we know.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll send you that, and you can have a look at that and see if it spurs any ideas, because it is essentially it's a has an environmental theme at the heart of it. But the other question was, so what are you going to do next?
I don't know if we can talk about it.
I think we can. Oh. I think we can talk about it.
Well, maybe we could talk about it in very vague terms.
Well, we've talked about it before, so I think it's okay to talk about it.
Yeah, all right. Go for it.
Okay.
Nobody listens anyway.
Well, that's all right then. Our next project we're working on is sort of quite similar to The Ragged Trouser Philanthropist in a lot of ways. It was written around the same time. But it's about the suffrage movement, Votes for Women.
So in a sense, this is the twin sister to The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist.
Yeah.
And it's by Constance Elizabeth Maud, who was on the front line, as it were, of the suffrage movement. And it's written in a similar sort of style. So there are political conversations, but what there mostly is actual action of how it affects people's lives and why it was important, in a similar style to Ragged Trousers.
Sounds good.
It's good because it's sort of humorous and witty and sharp. And one of the things that sort of binds the two books together actually is that they both use quite sort of verging on patronising accents for people.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, really?
Appalling, hideous working class dialogue.
Oh, Trestle was worse, I think, than Maud. I mean, in some ways, I'm quite impressed by Maud because she was the daughter of a vicar in Surrey, I think. But she's written all the action that takes place in Lancashire. She's actually written the dialogue in dialect, not just an accent, but actually in dialect.
So hard to read.
Even as Lancastrians, it's quite tough going to read it, because I think the idea of it was to write a book that would be appealing to mill workers as well as aristocrats, you know, to try and get the ideas of suffrage across to people who otherwise wouldn't have thought about it.
It was used as a campaigning tool.
Yeah.
Right.
So it's kind of aimed at mill workers, to try and get ideas across. So I think maybe that's why she did it that way. But, oh, my God, it's hard work. So Sophie's going through it now, translating it all into English.
It's got some interesting modern parallels, though, because there's the whole question of direct action and whether political violence is acceptable, which is very relevant right now. And there's a lot of questions of representation and, you know, what difference it makes if your kind of people are not represented in political class, what happens to the rights of your kind of people? So considering it's about something that people would generally think the argument is over, it's got some really current themes in it.
It sounds great. Sounds great. I'm looking forward to it. What's your schedule for that then?
A couple of years.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
It's not set in stone yet, but it'll be a while to draw it. I mean, Sophie's actually still writing it, so I'm going to work on all the chapter headings and then get onto it when the script comes through. Yeah.
That's something to look forward to. I've got one other favour to ask of you. I mean, you don't have to do this, and we can always cut this out where you tell me to go away. I don't know whether you've heard of bookshop.org, which is the answer to Amazon. We've just set up our store on there. If you would like to give a list of maybe a half a dozen books each that have inspired you, we'll put that as a reading list on our website as well.
I have to say that Sophie is much more highbrow than me in her book.
It doesn't matter. Really doesn't matter.
I think it's good, though, because we can make sure that The Haunted House and Burglar Bill get on there.
Yeah, I tell you, Burglar Bill is already on there. I tell you, it's in my list.
Well, one of my favourite books as a kid was an American book, but it had been adapted for the English market, called Old MacDonald Had Some Flats by Judith Barrett.
Right.
And it was basically, I think it's not very well known, but it was basically about a caretaker in a block of flats in America who found animals far more appealing than the tenants, and so as the tenants moved out, he'd move animals in, and the drawings are just so good. Sort of carrots coming through the ceiling into the flat below. It was one of my favourites as a child. I just love anything with detail like that.
It really frightened me, that book, because I think it was my first glimpse of anarchy.
But it was also about capitalism.
Very much,
The man who owned the apartment block, Fat Mr. Rental, he actually, I thought of him quite a lot when I was drawing Rushton.
It's a very Trestle name, isn't it?
Very.
It is. It's all very, I mean, it was very early 70s, I think, this book. It was, quite sort of hip.
Yeah.
Really? Can I ask
New
you?
York.
Sorry. Can I ask you a bookshop question? Which,
of course, you can. Yeah,
it's not appropriate. What's the difference between bookshop and Hive?
Well, that's a very good question. The Hive is owned by one of the major book distributors,
right?
Which is fine. It's fairly useful. Bookshops get more commission through Bookshop,
do they?
If that makes sense, than they do through Hive. Yeah. With Hive, it ends up as pence. With Bookshop, it's a little bit more. It's a bit closer to what you would get selling direct.
Right. Oh, that's good to know, because we're wondering, how to push things.
We've promoted Hive quite a lot as an alternative, before the shop existed. And then I didn't know whether to switch horses or what, because I wasn't. It's so opaque trying to work out who's making where. Trying to follow the money is almost impossible from the outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, as I think I've said before, well, certainly on social media, Amazon hasn't made any money at all from selling books until maybe a year or so ago. So all their spending, talk about capitalism, all their spending in that area was just to get share of that market. Yeah. To give credit to Hive and to Gardeners who run it, and I can't remember the company that owns the whole thing. They have been resisting that quite well.
Yeah.
I think Bookshop is just a little bit more high profile, and as I say, seems to be a little bit more.
Well, that was what we were wondering, because it's hard to tell whether, that people were sort of lauding bookshop.org as you know, the brand new invention that's, you know, going to fight back against Amazon. And we were thinking, but what about Hive? Hive's doing that, isn't it?
And a little part of me was waiting for Scooby-Doo to take the mask off Bookshop and discover that it's Amazon.
Yeah.
Right, you can just never tell whether it is really a radical new idea or just very well marketed. Yeah. Very well publicised.
That's true.
Yeah. I think it's probably marginally better, but I wouldn't be a character witness for it just yet.
Great. Yeah.
Listen, thank you so much. I'm sorry, I don't want to cut you off, but thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
And
thank you. It's been really good fun.
It has been lovely talking to you. Maybe we'll talk again, if not soon, but in a couple of years when that new book comes out.
Yeah.
That'd be really good.
We'll see you on Twitter anyway. Wave at
you. Yes. Yeah. Yes, of course. Yeah. And if you're in Tunbridge, you know, obviously call in to the bookshop.
She isn't actually that far away from me in the scheme of things.
Not really, but no.
It all rather depends on whether we ever leave the house again.
Yeah. Well, this is true. Yeah.
That is a big issue.
we'll hang on in there. Thanks again. And it's been really lovely talking to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So there you go. That was Scarlett and Sophie Rickard. And I really enjoyed that chat. And you can order their book, The Ragged Trousered Philanthropist, or indeed the other one, Man's Best Friend, from Mr. Books, of course, which, as we said, is also now to be found on ukbookshop.org. That's uk.bookshop.org. And don't forget to check the episode notes for links to the bookshop and the books that we mentioned. And also, and I keep forgetting this, take a look at the title words, which we link to an online visual dictionary, VisuWords. It's fascinating and interactive. That's visuwords.com. As always, Ideas in Writing is supported by Mr. Books Bookshop in Tunbridge, the home of independent, inspiring and imaginative books, gifts and conversation, including an exclusive range of book-related and Mr. Books-inspired T-shirts. So, you know, Christmas presents. Whatever you want to buy from us helps us keep our independent bookshop open. So, thanks again for listening, and see you next time when we're hoping it's going to be Ian McMillan, the amazing poet and familiar Radio 4 voice. See you then. Hello, if you enjoyed this podcast, you can support us. You just need to click on the link and become an Acast supporter. It's a one-off donation. You can give as much or as little as you like, and there's no commitment, but it certainly helps us to keep producing these podcasts. So thank you very much.